I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Gretchen Yost. She is a veterinarian with the Espanola Valley Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about anything else having to do with veterinary medicine and shelter medicine and things like that, let's talk for a moment about this fire that is going on. Los Alamos has a mandatory evacuation, and that has a tremendous impact on animal shelters in this area.
Absolutely. We have taken in about 96 animals. Most of them all came in after the mandatory evacuation was put in order. Folks coming down and checking into hotels or checking in with friends who unfortunately couldn't take their animals with them. So we decided early on and planned for it that we would try to get our animals, shelter animals, out into foster care and make room and make preparations for evacuees. We had no idea how many we'd actually have. There weren't actually that many for the Cerro Grande fire. But I don't think we as an organization put out the announcement that we would take animals at that time. This time we did, and so a little bit ambitious there, but it's all been very good, I think, for the animals, but ultimately for these, poor people that have had to evacuate.
So when people evacuate, they leave their houses, and sometimes they go stay at a hotel that doesn't take animals, or they stay at friends' houses who, for whatever reason, can't take animals.
Exactly, allergies or too many animals already, or too many, people. Not enough room. So I'm just very thankful that the people brought their pets with them. I had the opportunity to go down to Katrina after that hurricane, and as you know, there were lots and lots and lots of pets that were forced to be left behind. They wouldn't. They were
that
not.
That was one of the greatest travesties of the United States emergency system ever. Is that they would not take people who insisted on bringing their pets. You had to either let your pets die or die with your pets.
Absolutely, it was. And I remember a little old man that stayed in knee-deep water with his dog for 4 or 5 days, and his son forced him to evacuate in a boat, and but they would not let the dog come with them, and they were reunited weeks later, amazingly. But most animals were not reunited with their owners. I mean, a lot of them got new homes, which was terrific, but
and a lot of them died that didn't have to die.
Absolutely.
So here we have people evacuating with their pets, and so the animals that you already had at the shelter, those are the ones that you've been trying to find foster homes for.
Absolutely. And we did this, we kind of had a dry run back in February when we had the freeze in northern Mexico, and we lost the gas in Espanola. And at the shelter we lost not only heat but also water. And you can't really run a shelter like that. So within hours, we were able to mobilize our volunteers to come, and we cleared out the shelter in like I said, a matter of hours. So this time, it's kind of double the effort, because not only do we have to get our animals out, but, check the evacuees in. So, luckily, it's all gone fairly smoothly, amazingly enough.
The animals that are being fostered out, those are also, if somebody who's fostering them falls in love with them, do they get to adopt them?
Absolutely. Yes. There's applications, adoption applications, but there's also foster applications too. So anybody that we would foster to would be a wonderful home, for an adoption. So we actually call that failed fostering, because and I'm guilty of it myself, of adopting a foster. But ultimately, finding homes for these guys is what we're all about. So we'll definitely take that.
So we will see what happens, and we'll get updates in the coming days as this fire progresses, or maybe with some luck it'll rain, or who knows what'll happen.
Absolutely. It's kind of open-ended. We are prepared if we had to evacuate to evacuate all these animals with us elsewhere. So you always have to kind of keep that in mind too. But hopefully that won't come to that.
So the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, I mean, you guys are full at this point. I think Santa Fe is still accepting animals that need foster homes or that need a place to basically a place to crash for a while.
They sure are. And, you know, we've been very impressed by the number of calls we've got from Albuquerque veterinary clinics, you know, local veterinary clinics and all kinds of people and organizations that say, you know, let us know if you need any help, if you need any place to put animals. And so once again, we're blessed and pleased with the positive part of this tragedy. So,
what can people do who are listening who want to either donate their homes or donate stuff? What does the Espanola shelter need at this point?
Well, thanks for asking. Right now, we can always use volunteers. Call the shelter first, depending on what the situation is. It might be walking some dogs. It might be cleaning. Obviously, there's a lot of cleaning to do when you've got so many animals that you're feeding and caring for every day. We are asking for cat litter, the non-clumping kind. And we can always use food and dry food, puppy food, cat food, dog food. Yeah.
Have most of the animals that have come in been dogs, cats, equal amount of both, anything else?
Mostly dogs, I'd have to say, but I have been surprised at the number of cats that have also come in. And we did actually get two birds. And there was a bird rescue that contacted us and said that they'd be willing to take those birds because it's birds can be stressed, and so it's better for the birds to be in a low stress environment. So that's where they are now.
I would think birds would be stressed if there were cats and dogs around.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of had them separate, but still, it's controlled chaos there. So it's good to get the birds out.
We're talking to Gretchen Yost from the Espanola Valley Humane Society. So let's talk for a moment about shelter medicine. You are a veterinarian at an animal shelter. That's something that we haven't really talked about much on this show. There's a lot of veterinarians in private practice, I suppose, but you're a shelter vet. Is that a whole career path for people?
It sure is. And It used to be, I think, even when I was in vet school, and that was graduated 11 years ago, it seemed to be the place where you thought about retiring. Nobody actually thought about going as a new veterinarian into shelter medicine, and that's really turned around. And now there are specialty programs, certain classes that you can take in vet school, and renewed respect for the field and a lot more science that's going behind it and trying to do this well in terms of taking care of large volumes of animals in a stressed situation. And so vaccination protocols, how do you house them properly, how do you lower stress environmentally, it all plays a part in animal health. And ultimately, you keep the animals as healthy as possible, and then you can find homes for them better. Yeah.
What are some of the differences between a regular veterinary clinic and being a veterinarian at a shelter?
Being a small animal veterinarian in private practice, and I did that for about 7 years in a clinic in Espanola. It's a very hands-on with a single animal and then the client. I mean, there's a client-patient animal relationship that you have with every single interaction, and there's always there's lots of diagnostics, and you have to depend upon the owner and their finances a lot to determine how far you can go diagnostically with an animal, but ultimately you have more resources because you're dealing with an owner. In shelter medicine, you're dealing with a lot of animals, and a lot of these animals they don't come in the best of health. There's nobody that can tell you a history about them. Typically, most of our animals are strays or they're dropped in our drop box, so often I wish I had a medical history, but we don't have that luxury. And certainly, it's always finances are going to be always an issue in the shelter environment because there's just not enough money to do all those high diagnostics, and so you have to be more reliant upon you know, upon things like your stethoscope and a microscope, and so it's a different world. But you know, I love it because these are the absolute most helpless and needy animals that there are. I mean, there's not anybody advocating for them, so I feel very, very fortunate to be in a place that I get to advocate for them.
It sounds sort of like being a doctor in a third world clinic or something like that.
You know, I always say when I'm trying to describe this that it's kind of like the Peace Corps of veterinary medicine, you know, up there in Española. We're faced with a lot of challenges, and I kind of sought that out as a veterinarian, so that's why I kind of ended up in private practice there too, not so different from the shelter, dealing with a poor community. You know, they're not able to do as much for their animals, and so you are relying on the amazing strength of actually the body and the healing, and to pull animals through.
When you are working at a clinic that's really outfitted and has the latest and greatest stuff, what is some of the latest and greatest stuff in terms of diagnostics and treatment?
Wow. It's been a while since I've been in one of those places, but absolutely, and I'm very, very glad that these practices are out there and my colleagues are out there that specialize. But you can literally do for an animal most anything you could do for a person. I mean, there are specialists in everything from ophthalmology to cancer to neurology.
They don't give them cataract operations.
Absolutely.
They do?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. That's old news.
Really?
Yeah, it is. No, I was going to give you a price per eye, but that's long ago, so
right,
I don't.
Right.
Yeah. But absolutely. Absolutely.
And they have defibrillators and all the cardiac stuff for animals?
Sure. You can, very standard to have echocardiograms done on your animals to diagnose murmurs and things like that. And then depending upon the condition, and it's amazing, but animal physiology is almost exactly like humans. I mean, they just have hair and tails, you know, but everything that can happen to us can happen to them, you know, in terms of cardiac issues that might, well, actually they don't get the sclerosis, and, you know, so they don't need bypass surgeries, but I guess they eat better than we do.
We're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. So it does actually bring up for me a kind of question about whether animals should get the same level of medical care that human beings get in a society where human beings don't get sufficient medical care.
Hmm. Well, I'm often told by folks that that sometimes they wish that their veterinarian was their doctor.
I feel exactly that way.
And not so much because, that we don't do as much, but I think we, as veterinarians, And the way veterinary medicine is structured in this country is that you do have that general practitioner that you go to, and we look at the whole animal. We look at the eyes and the feet and the heart, and we touch the animal because you have to. You have to have physical contact with the animal, to diagnose it, because you're not able to talk to them, so I think. Because of that, you get a more global picture of a medicine of an individual. And sometimes I know I feel like human medicine is they're just focused on their organ system, and they don't see everything. And I apologize to any EMDs are out there. They're under the gun, doing a lot of great stuff. But
right.
So
it's really, without calling itself that, it's just by definition a kind of holistic medicine.
I absolutely think so. It's very hands-on, and of course I'm glad that there are specialists out there that you can, as a general practitioner, go ahead and get that cataract surgery done. You wouldn't want me doing that, absolutely. But for somebody who wants that done, it's there and it's safe and it's available, and I think people are demanding that.
What are the kinds of medicine or the kinds of procedures that you most frequently do in an animal shelter?
Well, that's easy. Spay neuter. It's all about spay neuter.
Ah, yes.
And so that's kind of one of the things that as a, you know, you, that's why shelter medicine was thought, well, you know, you want to retire there because you don't want to deal with people anymore. Maybe you can sit in the back room and you can do lots of spays and neuters and not deal with quote-unquote hard medicine. That's not what I think. Even though I do lots of spay neuters, and you become kind of an expert at that, and it's your niche, and you can do a lot more, and you can do them very safe, which is what we do to hopefully prevent the numbers, you know, of animals coming in that we have to find homes for. But you know, every once in a while, and well, not too infrequently, animals will come in with lacerations or wounds or things that you need to, you know, to do surgery on. I've done a few amputations, and some intestinal surgery, some things that, and eye, you know, taking out eyes, you know, if they have to, which is not my favorite thing to do, but when it has to be done. So we, yes, we specialize in spay neuter, but if a shelter animal is adoptable and needs something else and we're able to do it with our equipment there, we'll do it. And if it's the difference between doing it and not doing it, and that animal doesn't have a chance at a home.
To what extent do you engage in education in the community so that the kind of problems that are coming in won't happen as often?
Not enough. I wish we had unlimited funds to do that, to make that even a bigger part of our program at the Humane Society. You know, I'd like to, it'd be great to get out to all the schools and every kid in every classroom, and because I think that there's a lot to be gained by talking and showing the human-animal bond and reconnecting, you know, with kids and animals, because they're the ones that are going to change things in the future. But you know, we do some of that, absolutely, but you know, always looking for help to do more.
So ideally, with more funding, you'd have more education programs and get out into all the schools and all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. We do have a few, you know, great volunteers that you know are teachers as well. So you know, some of them bring their classes to the shelter and they volunteer and they really do work, and they do little fundraisers to, you know, to raise funds for the shelter, and there's a nice connection there. So any teacher out there that wants to kind of have that partnership, please let us know. We'd love to have that.
Now, you actually ended up adopting a dog who had quite a dramatic story.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that.
Jack. He's our famous dog now.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
He's been in the paper, everything.
Absolutely. And people from coast to coast seems like have heard about Jack. Yeah, Jack came in and, you know, I think he's older than the hills, probably close to 13, 14, 15, and he's a heeler. Very gray in the face, one floppy ear down, one up, and he came in with, gosh, how do I even, you know, describe this without being too grisly, but his right arm was essentially dead and mostly bone, and it had been that way a long time, very infected, and it needed an emergency amputation. The person that brought it in, you know, said at first he'd had him for 6 weeks and then said no. So investigation is pending on that. It happened to be actually a police officer, which made us kind of crazy. So
because there was a suspicion that the dog had been abused or neglected.
Well, you know, definitely neglected. If indeed this dog, Jack, was with this person for 6 weeks with his arm in such shape, I can't. It's just unconscionable that you don't do something about it. You know, even if it's I can't do anything, please, you know,
please
let
help.
Him go. Yeah. Or yes, absolutely. Even if you don't have the money, and that's what we, you know, we absolutely want people to come to us And we will try. I mean, I can't, you know, say that we will we'll be able to have the resources to fix every animal or whatever, but at least they have a chance and they don't have to suffer, and we'll relieve their pain and, you know, perhaps get them to a place where they can actually have a home. But don't let them suffer out there. And, the fact that he was a police officer just kind of elevated the thought that, you know, do you even realize that this is severe neglect, you know? And so we did push the issue, and there is a case pending for neglect and cruelty. In the meantime, Jack was a real trooper. We amputated the leg the next day, he was severely sick, and so I took him home for recuperation, all the while thinking that I'm just going to get him well, and then we'll find him a wonderful home. And his story got out there and touched so many people. We had lots of donations from far and wide, you know, $5 here, $25 there. It was very touching, and certainly enough to take care of him and many others, actually, that don't get so famous, you know. long story long, he's much better, and I thought I could let him go, but I just couldn't. So
another failed foster.
Absolutely. So I'm actually a little feel a little guilty about that, but.
But Jack is a happy dog.
He's a happy dog. Yep. And certainly one of our many, many success stories. So maybe through his plight, you know, we get donations so that we can help other animals medically. Maybe there's some folks, you know, locally that are kind of rethinking the whole animal cruelty neglect thing, and that, you know what, we're going to take this seriously, and, you know, maybe this will or won't, you know, have any legal implications, but we're not just going to look the other way.
There's so much to be said about the phenomenon of compassion, whether it be for other human beings or whether it be for other animals, noticing the suffering of others and doing what you can to alleviate it. And you can't save everybody, and everybody knows that, but when it's right in front of you, there's something you can do.
Absolutely, and you need to recognize it. So fear that some are a little numb to this, and you would hope that it wouldn't be your law enforcement, you know. Because whether it's a dog, or, you know, whether it's a child or an old person, you know, all the innocent, and maybe the ones that can't quite tell us exactly where they hurt or why they hurt or who hurt them, they're all kind of in one boat, and we need to recognize and be empathetic to all creatures. So
we're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. Now, how are we doing in northern New Mexico, in the areas that you see, in terms of education on the importance of spaying and neutering one's animals? I know that we've talked about this on the show a number of times, that Colorado's spay-neuter programs have been so successful that they have to import puppies from New Mexico. But we seem to still have an overabundance of unwanted animals because of people not spaying and neutering their pets.
Sure. And, I would say there's much, much, much more work to be done. There's certainly, we do in Española, we at our clinic 15 to 20 a day, and you would think, and that's up to a little over 3,000 a year. They do many here in Santa Fe at the spay neuter clinic, and of course private veterinarians are doing it all the time too. You would think that would make that would be all you would need, but not. The reproductive rate is so high that it just seems like we're having a hard time keeping up with everything. There's certainly, in a given day, there's certainly animals that I spay or neuter that, and I'm thinking, well, I think that the owner probably would have done that anyway, or these animals are probably in a house and they probably wouldn't have had puppies. But there are some that come in and you go, I'm so glad I am spaying this one that's probably had 5 litters already and probably going to have 5 more, and if I didn't do this. So I think it's challenging in our world to find those animals, and to get into those communities or find those are the ones that you need to get out there and spay and neuter. And they call that now, the buzzword is targeted spay neuter. And so that's going to be our challenge moving forward, is maybe analyzing more of our intake. And you know, where are these animals coming from? Who are they coming from? And getting out into those communities and going door to door, or you know, bringing the animals to the shelter for spay neuter. Of course, when you're looking at that, the cost per spay or neuter is just climbs. You know, so
of course, yeah.
Now, you started out, veterinary medicine is your second career. You started out as an electrical engineer. How did you switch over to this whole new life of becoming a veterinarian?
I was very lucky. I could follow my dream. I'd always thought about being a veterinarian, you know, being a little girl. And I think a lot of little girls go through that phase anyway. And then I took a trip to Auburn Vet School. And I saw heartworms in a jar, or something that really kind of wigged me out a little bit. And also, I used to, and I still do, cry at every single animal movie. Do not ask me to go to any animal movie. So everybody in my family said, you can't be a veterinarian. You can't. So I said, oh, okay, you know, I'll go over here and do this math and science thing that I like. And it was a good career. But I found that I was writing all my checks, you know, to the animal organizations. And I thought, well, why not get into the game? You know, I'm able to, and so I decided to go down that road and take night classes, and then apply to vet school, and was lucky enough to get in. Lucky enough to have some life savings that I could plunk down into a 4-year vet school. And
it's harder to get into, I've heard, vet school than medical school.
I think we veterinarians tell you that. I don't know. It makes us seem smart. I don't know about that. I know that there's fewer vet schools. There's only like 28 vet schools
right.
in the country. So, but I don't know if
yeah, that may be part of it.
Yeah,
is that there's just so many people who want to go to vet school. Did you meet other people who were doing second careers like you?
A few, sure. One of my best friends, she was a paramedic before and decided to go back. So we were kind of the older girl sat in the back row, and you know, the mother hens, I suppose, of the class. So
what is the greatest reward for you of being a shelter veterinarian?
I just, you know, as tired as I am at the end of every day, and that's physically and emotionally, I suppose, I feel really, really lucky that I actually have a job I care about. And I just don't think that a lot of people have that luxury of caring about it, about what they do. Every little life that I can touch and make better makes me better, makes me a better person, I think. And was that the question? I don't know. I kind of got into my teary stuff. So
no, but I mean, if you cry at animal movies, do you cry when you does it hurt you when you lose an animal that you're caring for?
Sure. Absolutely. I you do kind of become a little bit, and you have to kind of philosophical about end of life. And I think, you know, on a personal level, that's helped me with you know, losses in my life. My father passed away last year, and I think I've been able to handle that better because I'm around the circle of life so much, and I realize, and in my own head, I think, I just know I'm going to see all these guys again, you know, and I kind of picture when I kind of cross that rainbow bridge that all these little fluffy things are going to come and just pounce on me. I certainly hope it's that way anyway. So it makes
me... In the
me
sky where there is no animal shelter and they're all free.
Exactly. And they're all healthy and they're all, yeah, free of everything, you know. It's all good. So
once again, if people want to get in touch with the Española Valley Humane Society and make any donations of time, money, food, or anything else during this fire season, what should they do?
Absolutely. Give us a call at the shelter. 753-8662 is our number. And we've got, if you're interested in fostering, you know, they'll connect you to our foster coordinator, volunteer coordinator, if you're interested in volunteering. We can give you the latest thing that we might have run out of, paper towels or cat litter, if you are at the store and want to buy something. And of course, monetary donations of any amount are always welcome. It's always tough. It's a tough environment.
Gretchen Yost is veterinarian at the Espanola Valley Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.